Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
We don't know yet exactly what started the fires in Los Angeles, but most experts agree that certain environmental conditions certainly helped get it going. Climate experts say as we continue to see the impacts of climate change, we're also going to continue seeing increasingly severe disasters. Scott Stevens, fire science professor at UC Berkeley, is an expert in fire ecology and behavior, as well as environmental biology and forest policy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
So let's set aside politics and institutional preparedness, and let's just talk science to start. Let's talk about what it's like living in a world with 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. How quickly has that happened, and how are we going to continue to live in this?
That chaparral field bed is one of the most volatile field beds I've ever been around. I've actually done about 35 prescribed fires in chaparral and just seen behavior during moderate conditions. So when you get drying, more temperature, Santa Ana's keep coming. That's just something part of life in Southern California. But that drying is going to make it more difficult. We know we had a drought this year, and that fuel is really, really bad. But that's one of the more difficult fire environments in the world.
Tell me about these prescribed burns. This is something that you're actually studying, that the scientists in California are studying, around the world are studying?
Yes, you know, and this is something that we did. We did about 35 prescribed fires in Southern Mendocino County, just north here of Northern California. And we were just trying to understand if we could burn in spring, fall, winter, would we see a different ecological response? We also did mastication without fire where we ground the shrubs up. But we were burning in the spring, you know, with 70 degrees Fahrenheit, no wind, temperatures, you know, moderate, humidity maybe about 50%, and we still got 70-foot, 80-foot flame lengths from chaparral. So it is an incredibly volatile fuel bed, and when you have people near it, it's so difficult.
So what is the underlying cause? I mean, this is going back decades about what has sparked these fires.
Well, I think it's part of that environment. There's no doubt, like you said, that climate change is making it worse. I did see some research recently that the Santa Ana frequency is unchanged from climate change, but we do see Santa Ana's going later in the year, less early in the year, which is something that they maybe attribute, but they can't say for sure. But the real difficulty is when you have those kinds of winds, and it's not something that happens every 10 years, as we know. It happens almost every year. Sometimes you get ignitions with it, which are generally all human-caused. So all I think you can do is just try to get people and communities better prepared for fire down there. Inevitably, fire is going to come, unfortunately.
What do you mean by prepared? I mean, how can you? I mean, when you're looking at a 100-foot wall of flames, I mean, the only thing you can do is run.
Well, that's right. And, you know, a lot of those communities were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Many of them don't have really the standards yet for home structures to try to reduce ignition potential. So there's a lot to be done in kind of the urban communities. No doubt you can do some work in the wildland communities as well, doing fuel breaks, better detection. But I'm afraid it really is going to be more of just how communities, human communities themselves, are actually able to actually adapt to these new conditions. Some people wonder, can we just use drones, better detection? Can we just get all fires out? And the answer to that is no. We are always going to have fires down there because there are so many people. I always call people fire magnets. They just cause fires, mostly accidental. Unfortunately, you get some of these ignitions on really bad days. So then it becomes really, how does a human community prepare itself as best it can for these systems?
Okay, so right now in Southern California, you're looking at a lot of ash, a lot of rubble. When they rebuild, How can you rebuild differently? And is there something different that we can do this time? I mean, we've seen fires in Santa Rosa, in Paradise. What can we do differently? I mean, are we going to have, for example, subterranean basements so we can lock ourselves inside with maybe air in there to be able to survive something like this? Or is it more prevention? I mean, what are we going to do? What can we do differently?
You know, in some areas of California where we have forests, where we have more forests and woodlands, oak woodlands and things, we have a lot more we can do. Those systems, you can pre-treat them to reduce their fire hazards and really be in the ecology of those systems, and they actually, it's necessary. More resilience, better systems. So we can do a heck of a lot in Northern California to try to prepare ourselves for inevitability of fire, keeping flame lengths lower, easier to manage, far less damaging to structures. You get into a shrubland ecosystem, then you're really have far few options because the shrubland burns periodically with high severity fire, flame lengths that we talked about, but it regenerates fine as long as you don't get too many fires too frequently. Maybe every 10 years, 7 years, 15 years, you could change it to a grassland. So there's a lot of places in California where you can do good work today to make a huge difference, and we're beginning that work. Cal Fire is funding this, state is pushing on it, so we're doing pretty good in some areas. But it is something that in some ways never ends. That's another thing that's a challenge. Once you start this system up and you start getting better and better and you're reducing the vulnerability of places to fire, then you just got to keep at it forever. And indigenous communities, of course, have done this forever and continue to do so. Indigenous people live in California. It was a fire state then. It's a fire state now. They actually also burn around their communities and also do so today. So there's a lot to be learned from indigenous people.
Yeah, absolutely. What about clear cutting that chaparral? Is there any way to do that, or is it just native, so it's always going to come back?
Well, you can remove it and then change it to maybe to a less hazardous structure. Some folks down in Southern California plant succulents, low succulents, sometimes a little bit of grass in between. You get a little space between you and your house and maybe that chaparral field bed. Of course, non-native plants, sometimes that can be a real problem too because you can increase the non-nativeness. There's actually a lot of people or quite a few people in Southern California that think chaparral is a real important biome and they're trying to keep it from an ecological perspective. So, yeah, you can do some conversion of that biome to something less flammable and then work a lot in your neighborhoods to try to do better. And that is probably the best thing you can do down there. Try to reduce human ignitions. And this is an interesting idea, and it's important, you know, because all these fires that have started down there are human ignitions. Hopefully they're not arson. But when you have that many people, electrical infrastructure to supply people, homes, you know, roads, roadsides where you can start fires, there's just so much going on down there where you can get accidental ignitions, and they're never going to go away. But trying to get ignitions lower in red flag days is a big deal, but I don't know how to do it.
And when you talk about those prescribed burns, I mean, they've been in drought for so long. Is there any ever a safe day to do those prescribed burns when you get things so dry? I guess you just do it on non-Santa Ana wind days?
Yeah, you do. And, you know, and you could actually, one thing about chaparral that's actually an opportunity, you can burn in the dead of winter. Of course, it's dry down there right now, but typically you get some rain in the winter, even in Southern California. So up here, you can actually burn like right now. You know, we're looking outside. It's a beautiful day, a little bit too windy maybe. 7 days of nice sunny weather in the middle of winter, you can burn chaparral. And the nice thing about that, the grasslands hopefully are green already next to it. The oak woodlands got green grass. So you can actually burn that chaparral and almost have no ability for escape if you can pick your days wisely in the spring and also the winter.
Right now with those winds down there, there's almost that tornado power of those winds. How do you either fight against that or escape that?
Well, that's a good one, too, because you're right. When you get 70-mile-an-hour wind and you're pushing it against a fuel bed that's already stressed because of drought, you're going to have flame lengths 150 feet. So they're really, in those conditions, there's almost nothing human that we can do after, you know, those fires ignite. Certainly, we're doing the work ahead of time, right, trying to get more insulation or more fuel breaks around our communities, get our structures better prepared for sparks and spotting. But then you basically make a plan. This is something that's also important because you can't make a plan to evacuate when you have a fire at your front door. You've got to do this with your community, with your household, with your neighbors, months and months ahead of time. I used to go to Australia quite a bit, and they actually routinely get together once or twice a year as a community in a subdivision to talk about what they're going to do, actually, if a fire shows up on their doorstep. They're going to help the neighbor next door that doesn't have a car. The lady down the street just had a baby. We're going to make sure she gets out. So they actually make a plan together to try to actually have something that they can execute when that fire hits. You can't plan when you got a fire at your doorstep.
That's so true. And you mentioned the other parts of the world. Of course, we're not the only tinderbox area, and we're not even, you know, there's other continents as well. Is there a clearinghouse, if you will? Can we learn from each other?
We can. And I look to Australia. You know, I look to Australia. They've had some of similar fires as us, but they've actually, I think, engaged human communities better in solutions. One thing we have here in California, we have the University of California Cooperative Extension. Cooperative Extension are people that actually are trained in different fields, and they actually stay in the counties. They don't go to Berkeley. They don't go to Davis. They actually are in the counties, but they're academics. And there's about 7 or 8 of them right now in California that are fire advisors. So they're working in counties, trying to get people better prepared, talking about fuels, talking about the urban interface, all the stuff we're talking about. And they do an excellent job at connecting information to human communities. I think the Cooperative Extension Program in fire needs to actually increase by 2 or 3 fold. And we're not talking about billions of dollars here. We're talking about probably maybe a couple million or something like that. But I think then you would have more people in these human communities that actually prepare people. As far as I know, there's only one cooperative extension advisor in Southern California in the fire area.
Oh, that's interesting. It's a great suggestion. What's the role of the high sea surface temperatures, those increasing temperatures in our fires, if anything?
Well, I think we just get more of the El Nino, La Nina, you know, and we're seeing some variation on this. La Nina is this year. I believe it's a weak La Nina. A lot of times, a weak La Nina means Southern California is dry. So in some ways, this has been predicted, right? La Nina conditions, we basically expect Southern Cal to be dry. El Nino conditions, we think Southern California wet. So those are just huge parts of the natural climate cycle that are actually still continuing to vary and affect all of us.
Well, in California, it seems like we've got this boom-bust cycle. I know up in Tahoe, you can go and have, you know, oh my gosh, there's, you know, 12, 15-foot snowdrifts, and then the next, you know, months later, there's nothing. And that's the same thing with the rain, you know, in Northern and in Southern California. Can we use those cycles to our advantage and do things during, you know, wet times and do other things during dry times to ease things for ourselves?
Yes, you can. And this is, you've hit a great suggestion, because there are places today when we have these droughts, especially in Northern California, where we have these drought periods, we can actually have, like we talked about a moment ago, 2 weeks of really dry weather. If you don't have snow on the ground, you can actually do an incredible amount of prescribed fire in Northern California. And those opportunities weren't around when I was early in my career. I started this in 1991. But now we're starting to see more, because climate change tells us, we're going to have more variation in weather, and that variation is going to be more droughts, probably more wet periods. And we can use those periods like the winter and the spring to do more work. But the problem is we don't have a workforce, because we have a workforce that's tied to fire suppression. Generally, that's around May or June through maybe October, and a lot of the seasonal people go away, and we don't have a workforce yet that actually can take advantage of these opportunities we're talking about. But I think it's actually paramount. We've got to get more people working when the opportunities arise to do hazard reduction in these systems, and climate change is opening windows that we can't cover right now.
What about ways to store more water?
I think the water piece is important. You know, I know we've heard a lot about Southern California and the hoses going dry and everything, and this is certainly a concern. Generally, most fires, we're never limited in water. I think this condition down there where we had multiple fires happening simultaneous strained the water system to a point where, of course, we didn't have it. But in the vast majority of fires, even the bad ones, the Wine Country fires, the 2020 fires we've had up here, water source has never really been a giant problem. It really is that pre-work that we're talking about that's really necessary to make a difference.
Yeah, and some of the planning where they were talking about, well, we can put out a couple of house fires, but we can't put out, you know, when blocks and blocks go up at once. So I'm not sure what the answer is. One thing I want to ask you about with regards to science is our human health. I mean, this is impacting us on a human level, our very own lung capacity and ability to breathe.
And that's a part that's changed. You know, again, in the early 90s, we used to have a few large fires. In the early 90s, a big fire in California was less than 10,000 acres in forest. You think about that a minute. You know, less than 10,000 acre wildfire in forest. We had the Dixie Fire, 2021, it was close to 1 million. So we are changing the fire sizes. Climate change is a piece of that. I think forest structure in those systems is actually a bigger piece. But it's impacting everyone now. It never used to. You know, now we're smoking out whole communities for months at a time. That's happened in the Bay Area repeatedly. It's happened in L.A., Portland, Seattle, even New York City. So you're right. This is a piece that's really taking the fire equation to really impacting so many more people and actually having health detrimental impacts, which are real.
When we have fires like this, of course, we're thinking about preparation. In closing, could you offer our listeners some suggestions of the best ways to get prepared?
Right. One thing I always try to say is there's hope. You know, I think a lot of times people feel that there's just no hope at all. You know, we're just getting our cans kicked or something like that. But there is hope. You know, there's no doubt that this fire situation is going to be in California forever. I know we're called the Golden State. I call it the Pyro State because fire used to be and continues to be just one of the most important processes that actually have shaped the vegetation and the people that lived in California forever. So it just means we work in these systems like the forest, the woodlands, the grasslands. We do work in those systems today to actually reduce their hazard. And we also simultaneously work a lot more in human communities to do a lot better. University of California Cooperative Extension, if you Google that, they actually have fire resources, talk about what people can do at their scale of their home. So there is hope. There is great hope, but we have to act decisively.
We certainly appreciate your insight. Thank you so much. That is Scott Stevens, a fire science professor at UC Berkeley, expert in fire ecology and behavior.
Today, we're forecasting the year ahead for the electric car industry as lawmakers grapple with the shift towards electrification. To talk about this and more, we're joined live by Mark Rechten, managing partner and auto industry consultant at Neutral Media. Mark, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
As you've probably heard, we've got this battery storage facility, lithium-ion battery storage facility that's burning down in Moss Landing. And I'm wondering if any surveys or anything have shown how the public feels about the possibility of battery fires. There were some in Teslas that burned intensely that were well covered.
Well, this is a fractious issue because, I mean, gasoline-powered cars burst into flames all the time. You know, the method of putting the various types of fires out is a little bit different for a gas car versus an electric car with a lithium-ion battery. And because it's a new technology, the media does tend to jump on it. So, I mean, it's a matter of picking your propulsion technology, but either way, you're storing an immense amount of energy, and when that energy is released, it does tend to combust.
So let's talk about the fact that we have a new administration coming in, one that has not been, one whose rhetoric, at least, has not been that friendly to the EV industry. So what do you think we'll see this year regarding that?
Yeah, this is definitely a cloud on the horizon for people selling electric vehicles. The Trump administration has made no bones about wanting to get rid of the $7,500 EV incentive. And then that's where we're going to see the elasticity of demand for electric vehicles, how price-sensitive consumers are to these vehicles, and what kind of other incentives now automakers will have to create to sell them. I think what's more alarming is that Trump likely will roll back federal requirements for EV production that the Biden administration put in place. So you'll see all those projected future purchases to government fleets evaporate. And that was supposed to be a key element to a lot of automakers building great sums of these cars. And if all of a sudden those, you know, pretty much guaranteed government fleet contracts go away, that changes their business proposal.
Not only that, but this is all happening as the prices of EVs are finally coming down to a place where the average person can afford them, not the top-of-the-line Teslas we had a decade ago.
That's correct. But at the same time, while we see price parity, consumers still aren't really willing to jump on board. You know, in some places, you know, San Francisco, L.A., Seattle, the big cities, you're seeing, you know, a certain amount of people really wanting to get involved. But in the heartland, not so much. And so you're seeing a lot of incentives to move these EVs that are greater than what you would see for a regular gasoline car. For example, in Colorado, there's a Fiat dealer who is leasing the Fiat 500e electric vehicle for free. Zero down, zero payments front. He's so desperate to get these unsellable vehicles off his lot. And nationally, Volkswagen has a campaign for $1,000 down and 149 month lease for 24 months on its ID4 electric SUV. Now, by comparison, Volkswagen has the same size SUV called the Tiguan, gasoline powered, and to lease that, it's $3,500 down and $260 a month. So you're talking thousands upon thousands of dollars of incentives just so the desperate automakers can get these vehicles off of dealer lots.
Is this still a consequence of range anxiety, or is there more to it?
There's more to it. I mean, it's a new technology. People are always suspicious of that, especially once you get outside of, you know, tech hubs like Silicon Valley or Los Angeles or Miami, places like that. But I think it's also just people are comfortable with what they've always driven. And when you look past the big hub cities, when you go to the heartland states, EVs make up less than 3% of sales. And that is a chasm. It's called crossing the chasm. It's a longstanding business formula, and it's you get the early adopters, and they tend to be in big cities, but you have to convince the bulk of the population that it's in their best interest as well. And right now, if you're looking at, you know, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, St. Louis, Boise, Idaho, you're not seeing the kind of EV sales turnover that makes this a sustainable business model.
We also haven't seen the explosion in the number of charging stations that we were told we were going to see too.
That is correct. And while the Biden administration did make rather large promises, those did not really come to pass. You see some of them out there. I think the real issue in you can't just will these charging stations into place. They require a massive amount of electricity. You have to really get the grid to be reliable in those cases. If you want to build a big charging station, you know, midway down the 5 freeway between L.A. and San Francisco, the amount of electricity that draws from that is basically the same as a, 50-story skyscraper. So in order to be able to have the grid support that and send that kind of power to a charging station that could do that, it's a pretty big infrastructure challenge, not to mention all the permits that are required, all the bureaucracy these things to go to. And then you multiply that by how many vehicles are already in place and then try to accommodate for future demand, even if sales are slower than expected, you're still talking tens of thousands of these locations. And that's going to be a really difficult technological hurdle, let alone bureaucratic.
So these headwinds we've been talking about are going to really affect legacy automakers and auto distributors. Is Tesla an outlier when it comes to this? Are they going to be affected by the same factors that affect everybody else?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Tesla still has about 50% market share in electric vehicles, but they did suffer a sales decline last year. And perhaps more startling, they've shut down the line for their brand-new, much-hyped Cybertruck. This is a vehicle that had 2 million reservations, and they are slashing production after less than a year and offering huge discounts to sell them. And perhaps most terrifying, if you're Elon, is that less than 3% of those 2 million reservations are now actually spoken for. Everybody else has walked away. And that's just in the United States. The European Union, which was expected to be a market for, has actually banned the Cybertruck from the territories. So that market's actually closed. So what does this mean financially for Tesla? This is an expensive R&D and manufacturing investment. The bespoke platform that's not shared with its other cars, with bespoke tech, bespoke running, this is going to be a huge amortization hit for Tesla in fiscal quarters to come.
So why did the Cybertruck fizzle?
Well, I think there's a lot of people trying to parse through the data to figure that out. I think that the vehicle makes a kind of statement that is rather aggressive, and there's a certain type of person who buys that. But are they willing to switch out of their, Ford F-150 or their Chevy Silverado or Ram 1500 for it? Those tend to be very brand loyal segments, full-size pickup. And when you look at, you can't say enough about Elon's rather dramatic political shift from being sort of the hero of the Green Army to now being at Trump's right hand. So when you look at the people who had been buying Teslas and now suddenly they may feel a bit betrayed by Elon's sudden dramatic shift, that could also affect, maybe they thought, hey, I can be a green warrior and drive a Cybertruck too. And now they say, maybe I don't want to be part of that person's entity at all.
Well, one of the things I hear, and I like the euphemism you used about it, but people say to me that they just think it's ugly.
Well, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and it is a very aggressive shaped vehicle. But I think also somewhat comes to it is that there isn't a whole lot of practicality in creating the bed that's triangular shaped as opposed to rectangular shaped. It does affect what can be held in the cargo area. It looks cool, but you know, there's the old adage of if you want a pickup truck to work, it's got to hold a four by eight sheet of plywood. It has to be able to hold, you know, 2x4s. It's got to be able to handle very bulky equipment. And when you have a triangular shaped bed, that kind of removes that from the equation. So if you're a work truck buying contractor, there's not a lot of desirability in, you know, a package that doesn't meet your needs.
Now, some of the automakers were facing pushback from their own unions about switching people who were making gas-powered vehicles into their EV divisions where there were differences in pay and benefits and things like that. Has that been settled, or is that still a major sticking point?
Well, if you follow the unions, it's a major sticking point. I think to the average consumer, it doesn't really make much difference. I mean, I don't think a lot of people know, you know, that, you know, some Fords are made in union shops, some Fords are made in non-union shops, some are made in Mexico, some are made in, you know, Far East. So I think a lot of people don't really understand how American their cars are or their electric vehicles are. You know, there's plenty of componentry that comes from China that goes into these things because China has dominated certain portions of the pieces that go in the building and electric vehicle. So if not for the actual refining of the lithium, China owns most of the world's lithium mines and other rare earth elements that go into electric vehicles. And this is part of the ongoing, you know, trade disputes that we're going to be having with China in the years to come is, you know, how do we get these pieces of our vehicles if China has a stranglehold on their supply?
I'm glad you brought this up, and I'll make this the final question that we look into. But China has its own robust EV industry, but you wouldn't know that from America because their cars aren't sold here. What's the future of that?
Yeah, this is, again, going to be a trade dispute. And China right now is selling a lot of EV vehicles because the government is forcing them on consumers. Obviously, China is the farthest thing from a free market economy. It's a government-controlled one. And the CCP decides what kinds of cars, Chinese cars, the Chinese citizens will buy. And since China is building the global lion's share of EVs, Chinese citizens are being coerced into buying them, sometimes by, I could say, canny bureaucratic means. You know, say you want to buy a gasoline car in China, even if it's Chinese made, it can take months, if not years, to get a license plate. But if you buy an EV, you go right to the front of the line, get your expedited license, you're out on the road. So there are some pretty tricky tricks that that the CCP is putting in place to make sure that their electric vehicle industry is moving along. As far as how they are expanding into the rest of the world, they are making inroads in Europe, sometimes buying European brands. The fabled MG brand in Britain was purchased by a Chinese automaker, and now the MG brand is selling Chinese electric vehicles. You might see that happening with certain endangered U.S. brands that are currently, well, I wouldn't say they're up for sale, but their future is in doubt. And might that be a way for a Chinese automaker to make their way into the U.S.? Perhaps.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this. That's Mark Rechten. He's managing partner. And
you've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.